Dear Sir Stroke Madam Stroke, people of the universe, please attend carefully. No wait, that's been done before with little rhyme and reason to boot. Start the letter again. Dear Sir Stroke Madam, I wish to complain about some of the disregard and contempt the broadcasters of this particular podcast with a K will be showcasing in approximately 23 minutes from the moment you are reading this. These are insensitive criticisms laid against the first two series of Torchwood. These comments are flippant and bound to offend the many tortured fans of series 1 and 2, some of which in particular prefer not to have anyone else express opinions contrary to their own. To this effect, given my time-sensitive powers of foreknowledge fused sexually with retrospective memories of recording this particular event, I have given you 23 minutes in which to ban, censor, or deal with these comments before they occur to you or any sensitive listener's ears. I would further demand, when one of the two idiots tries to make a weak derogatory joke at Torchwood's expense in around 26 minutes' time, you at least censor out his utterance. Yours in advance. The idiot in question, James McLean. Christian Corley with a C, lead us into Casterbrus Podcast with a K, please.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the newest Casterbrus Podcast with a K. My name's Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Casterbrus. Joining me this time is super podcast wizard extraordinaire, James.
Hello there.
Hello there. How are you doing?
I'm pretty perky after my 2 weeks off in the sun.
Lovely. Did you go anywhere nice?
No. I sat here waiting for 2 weeks for my next Casterbrus podcast, actually.
Oh,
food stains and other stains all over me as I've waited, passing the time.
That's terrible.
It is, isn't it? It is.
Sorry to do that to you. So, we'll crack on anyway. We've got a couple of things that we'd like to talk about this week. But naturally, we'll start off with the most important thing, the Doctor's wife. What did you think of her?
I think it was interesting, given what we were talking about a few weeks ago on the Doctor's wife, what it was going to be like, what was it going to be about, what was it not going to be about.
Yeah.
And what they threw at us in the end was very different to what we were speculating or trying not to speculate on. It was totally different ballpark, which is what we kind of said they'd probably do, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, I really liked it. It did make me think a few things while I've been sitting in this chair for 2 weeks, and it took the pain off. It took the pain away from the growing arthritis in my knees from sitting here. Why did I like it so much? And this was an interesting question because I'm sure we can both agree there is what has been known in Doctor Who fandom to be called a lot of fan wank.
Yes.
How much of it, and in fact I'll pose this to you so it's not me monologuing, did you enjoy it, and did you enjoy it, do you think, for the story, or was it the fan wank, or was it both? What was it that you liked about it?
Well, I'm going to base this on my initial viewing.
Yeah.
Because it's always best to do that. Now, my initial viewing took place with my wife, my sister-in-law, my two nieces, various pieces of home-cooked pizza and wedges, my sister-in-law knocking glasses of lemonade over, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So a typical domestic setting. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was marvellous. I think it was a very simple idea, one that surprisingly no one has come across before. There's nothing like remarkable about the idea. The remarkable thing is that no one's done it before. It's never popped up in a new adventure in any of the Virgin books. Various plays on what the TARDIS and the Doctor's relationship have, and different things have been done with the TARDIS, but that specific particular idea hadn't been done. The dialogue was great. Yes, there were things that talked about, dialogue that referred to other things, but I found that they were phrased in such a way that they didn't actually have to mean anything specific.
Yeah.
Which kind of gets around the whole issue of the fan wankery. It was just a really well-rounded, interesting, gripping story that, although I didn't mind the pirate adventure the week before, I think the pirate adventure was just a change in pace, possibly because the events of the first two episodes and this one were kind of turned up to 11.
Mm. There's nothing wrong with fan wank. There's nothing wrong about liking little bits of the past being thrown into a show, because I think it helps our minds connect the dots, because we want to be able to feel a continuity there. And when we hear about him jettisoning 30% of the TARDIS, when we see what is a very much a homage in the TARDIS that was created by the kids, for Blue Peter, there's a lot of homage to the old style TARDIS consoles.
Yeah.
And we like that because it reconnects us. And the same with the control room, the secondary control room or the common control room. And you think, well, is that always a bad thing? I don't know.
I think the key is how you do it, how it's executed. I mean, if Stephen Moffat hired Neil Gaiman and he came out with something that resembled Attack of the Cybermen, then they'd both be lynched because it'd be rubbish.
Mm.
Because, you know, that's just blatant referring for no particular reason to an episode that occurred 17 years before, something like that, that is visually different, is thematically different, and basically doesn't really have any connection other than the fact that the setting's similar and the writer's put in loads of dialogue that says it's the same. Another one's Time Lash, okay? Pointless fan wankering there. How the hell does Perry know what Joe Grant looks like? If you haven't seen Time Lash, people, there's a bizarre moment when there's a reveal of the Third Doctor and Joe Grant in some sort of artistic form behind a big screen, revealed dramatically, and Perry recognises that it's Joe Grant and the Third Doctor. I mean, there's no way that she could possibly know this unless, you know, the Doctor keeps snaps of all his companions. Maybe he does. Well, I mean, we've seen that he does, haven't we? Or the TARDIS does.
Yes.
But in one of the extras, but it's a bit unlikely that Perry would have known what Joe Grant looked like.
But
or cared.
We can do a nice segue, because a few weeks ago I was talking about the completely useless encyclopedia, and I remember it taught me about Time Lash was that, of course, if you rearrange all the letters, you get lame shit. And it does. Have a think about it. I'm pretty sure it does. I've never actually got a piece of paper and checked. I took their word for it. But it looks about right.
Yeah, I think it probably is, looking at it, yeah. And the thing about, I mean, how the hell have we got the Time Lash from the Doctor's Wife?
Fan wank, that's what it is. I mean, fan wank is a very generic term. And I don't know. Anyway, I loved it. I thought it was a great episode. And I think part of it was because it indulged in something which I've always loved. I've always loved the TARDIS. So it's a fascinating thing. And I've never understood why the show has always avoided actually exploring, really, the use of the TARDIS, aside from Edge of Destruction, Legopolis, and arguably Invasion of Time, where really they didn't really explore it. They literally explored it, but you didn't really learn anything about it. It was just another setting.
I think you learned a few things about the TARDIS in that, such as the power room being like an art gallery.
I suppose,
and the fact that no one knows what level they're on.
Yes, I suppose there was that, the fact that you could get lost in it. There was an interesting bit in Confidential where Neil Gaiman was going on about how the TARDIS has evolved through the history. And it is actually quite true. Again, I was having to sit in my chair, rubbing my arthritic limbs, thinking about this. You know, that originally when it was Hartnell, there was never really any inference that it was a virtually eternal space, an eternal dimension. It was really pretty much like a large house. And Patrick Troughton, you barely saw much apart from the control room and the power room. John Pertwee did exist pretty much in that single control room, even had a bed in there for Planet the Daleks. And it's not until Invasion of Time that you actually see this notion that it could be sprawling, dimensions folding, anything. And then can you think of a time before that?
Is it The Mask of Mandragora when they introduced the panels, the brown panels?
That's true, yes, they do. Yes,
and the Doctor and Sarah Jane are having a wander around and stumble upon it. So I think that kind of...
Oh, I'm going to have to edit you out there and have to edit that in as if I'd thought of that. But no, you're quite right. Mask of Mandragora, not Invasion of Time. I was out by about 10 stories. But yeah, you're quite right. That was the first. But up until Tom Baker, it really didn't have this notion of it being so dimensionally complex. And yet, being a person, I suppose, of the John Nathan Turner era, that's the notion that I've always accepted. And it's funny that. And yet, yes, and it's never really been capitalized on. And it's such an obvious sci-fi notion, such a cheap notion. I mean, I'm not saying this episode was cheap, but you obviously got a lot of things being reused there. I mean, obviously their budget's been slashed this year again, but you've got, you know, the secondary control room, the coral control room, so you've got no design needed there. You've got the prop. Mm-hmm. You know, the Ood came out again, which didn't really have much point to the story at all. But again, you've got a recycled design, and you know, you've only got what, four or five players.
Yeah.
It's a cheap, nice story, but a fascinating one, because you're dealing with this intrinsically fascinating aspect of Doctor Who, which, by and large, is left at the beginning and at the end of every story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this, as I say, I mean, it's been touched upon in various adventures, the relationship between the Doctor and the TARDIS, just as what you're talking about there with the massive dimensions, the infinite capacity, the space inside the TARDIS has also been touched upon, or even focused upon in various new adventures and BBC books adventures, such as Mark Platt's Time's Crucible.
Yes.
The Cat's Cradle story, where it turns out the action is taking place in the TARDIS.
Yeah.
After it's been sort of invaded and turns in on itself, right the way up to the final Eighth Doctor novel, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Gallifrey Chronicles, is it?
Gallifrey Chronicles, yeah, where it turns out that there's a false wall at the back of the TARDIS.
Yes.
Where K-9 is hiding.
Yes.
And we'll tell you no more about that.
Yes, it's a good story, that. Another Lance Parkin one.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Fritz, isn't it, at the back wall. Zagreus, the Big Finish anniversary audio adventure, that also has quite a strong inference of the TARDIS and
right. The
TARDIS being upset with the Doctor, and a sort of almost like this very strong bond relationship tie, if I remember correctly. Been a mm-hmm. while since I've heard it. So it does pop up, this idea of the TARDIS being so sentient, and this idea of the Doctor being almost in love with the machine. I also noticed something that a lot of people never picked up on in Parting of the Ways, when Rose is talking to the Doctor at the end with all the time energy, is that people don't spot that a lot of the dialogue there is meant to be the TARDIS. It's not meant to be Rose when she calls him my Doctor. That, from what I remember reading anyway, that was actually meant to be the TARDIS speaking through Rose.
Really?
It's a conversation between Rose TARDIS and the Doctor, and there's that sort of merge. And I think that was picked up on this episode, because again, right. She calls him my Doctor in a very similar way, very similar echo from Parting of the Ways.
I've come over all emotional thinking of that.
It was an emotional episode, and it was very funny like that. Very emotional.
Mm.
I mean, I agree. I think a lot of fans will love it more for the notion of the TARDIS and the Doctor's relationship. And maybe that's what I'm sort of coining wrongly as fan wank, you know, something because it's something that fans will be instantly receptive to, probably more than the audience, the main audience. But I mean, there were some things in the story which were a bit flat, I thought. I thought that the Ood, obviously, as I say, really didn't have much point in there. But again, as I say, if it saves them money and it introduces a character which people like, there's nothing wrong in that. It didn't do any harm. Secondary console room, the coral, lovely to see again. I can see that's why they had it in there. In Confidential, they say that as well, that they were very excited to bring it out for the new team. But it didn't really have that much point in the story apart from one switch to be flicked. So there was a lot of stuff in there which was a bit loose and not very possibly story relevant, which was very aesthetic. But I don't think that really took away from the story in any way at all. I think you could watch that even without having any interest in the TARDIS and still find a lot of stuff there to connect with. Smith's performance at the end, when he's virtually crying with his sexy TARDIS, that was... Mm-hmm. Very emotive. There's some lovely little bits where, God damn it, you've killed Kenny again. Rory pretty much dies, and you've got... So that's very nicely played out, the tension there.
What did you think of the writing on the wall sequence? I enjoyed it, but I did feel it was a little bit strong for the audience.
Does this come back to what we were saying a few weeks ago, when I was young, nubile, and not with achy joints, that the show does seem, even in its lighter episodes, like this, well, I suppose this week and last week are lighter episodes, it still feels a lot more adult. It doesn't feel as if it's really catering for kids as much as maybe as it did even last series. Do you think that's the case?
I think last year it did. I think they would have backed away from something like the deaths at the beginning of the second episode of the series, or the writing on the wall that, what was it, I hate Amy Pond or something like that, all over, scrawled all over. That was horrific. That was like going through a subway and seeing all horrific graffiti daubed in blood and all other manner of bodily fluids. It was horrible. There's every reason for them to take that path, though. I mean, everyone who started watching Doctor Who for the first time last year is now 1 year older now. That's not going to cover all of the audience, but there's a big portion of audience that's been watching since 2005, and a larger portion of more mature audience, such as ourselves, who've been watching since the 60s or 70s or the 80s, or even came to Doctor Who via the books and the audios. And I know there are people who did do that. Are they captured? It's a difficult question to answer. It's definitely more mature than it was last year. Whether or not it's right or not, it's another matter entirely. But, and I don't want to tempt fate here, but as of Monday evening when we're recording this podcast, after that particularly horrific moment, where I found it horrific, and, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, and I was watching with young children, and I did wonder whether or not they'd be scared by it.
Yeah.
The corridor moment, the Daily Mail have been, you know, hounding Doctor Who for the last few weeks, and they haven't said anything about it.
Yeah, well, I think that comes down to the fact that I think kids, what kids find scary is not necessarily what adults find scary. I oh my God, I think I'm almost agreeing with the Daily Mail here. I've got to be careful. I think for an adult, that is more scary because there's so much more an adult can connect with. I remember when I think of being a kid, things which were more fantastical, I found more scary than things that were real. I remember for Water of Mars, that they said in Water of Mars at the end that they had to switch the bullet gun to a laser gun because there was a note that said that they felt that that Adelaide killing herself with a bullet was too explicit and too hard for children, while a laser gun was perfectly fine, you know, totally right. Different. But I still think that that sort of thing doesn't really touch kids. I think that sort of thing touches adults. Mm. And adults look at kids with adult eyes. I think kids would be more horrified by watching a person being parasitically controlled by a fantastical water virus than they would be about Adelaide shooting herself behind closed doors with a bullet. But I think an adult would be different. And I think for adults, that scene was probably more disturbing than children. I would guess. I could be wrong.
Finding a decayed corpse? Yeah.
I don't know. I think if I was a kid, I'd be more scared of the silence than I would be of anything in that episode. I think the silence would freak me out. But that maybe I'm different. I don't know. But it's an interesting point. It was very graphic. So, yeah, I mean, while it was quite mature, it was also quite it was quite fantasy. It was quite, trying to think of Tim Burton-ish in a lot of ways, I felt, the beginning. Very Neil Gaiman. Mm. I liked the beginning. I liked the patchwork people. I thought that worked really well. And the setting was beautiful. I just think before we move on to anything else, we should mention the guest stars for that episode, because I think they really brought it together.
Indeed, they did. Obviously, there was Saran Jones,
who was brilliant throughout.
Brilliant as Idris, whose work is probably more well known to regular television viewers as the terminally stroppy Karen McDonald in Coronation Street. Well, she's done loads of other stuff as well. But she was absolutely marvellous in, I think she appeared in the serial with David Tennant last year, didn't she?
Yeah.
Single Father. But yeah, she was absolutely marvellous as the embodiment of the TARDIS. It was excellent. And you've also got David Frost / Brian Clough, actor Michael Sheen, in there as well as the voice of the house.
And he was very good as well.
He was. He, dare I say it, he out-Sutek'd Sutek. In some ways.
It was a very good creepy voice. Yeah. And I think Matt Smith as well, because I always felt that the last series, Matt Smith didn't get that much to chew on. It was a lot of playing the eccentric Doctor. And if you think of how much Eccleston and Tennant had so far as dramatic stuff to eat into as an actor, he's had a fairly run-of-the-mill sort of performance. A great performance, very believable, but he's never really felt like he's really had to push himself much. And I felt in that episode, you got to see a few sides to him which we hadn't seen before. And I kind of like this side to him that we have where he doesn't go the mad Tennant way, you know, when he's angry. His anger is far more contained and withheld. And while I think I actually personally prefer that Tennant, you know, when he's pissed off, he's seriously pissed off. But I like the way that Smith isn't just redoing that, he's got another approach to it. And, you know, when he's, like, when he tells the two, you know, run, there's a certain malevolence there. There's a certain, yeah, you know, don't mess with me, but it's not done in the same way as the previous Doctor.
Yeah. I mean, so much about it was really well done. Great design. The whole, everything just came together really well for it, basically, at the end of the day.
It did. It was brilliant.
The writing, the acting, the mise-en-scene, and that was just an opportunity for me to say mise-en-scene.
I was very impressed that you found a reason to say that. And I am just going on to Google to find out what it actually means.
It's a marvellous episode, and I think it's, not only is it a marvellous episode, it's not only is it one that people have been waiting for 2 years or so, I think it's one that we will remember for a long time, such as a comparable episode, like Utopia.
Yes.
Certainly the last 10 minutes of Utopia.
Oh, you know? I loved Utopia. Yeah.
Great. I think there's something very long lasting about The Doctor's Wife.
Yes, I agree. So moving on, what else we've got? We've got Torchwood this week, haven't we? Well, we haven't literally got to, well, we have. We have 10 seconds, literally, of Torchwood this week.
Yeah, on Monday, there was 10 seconds of, or a 10-second teaser trailer of Torchwood Miracle Day released. We featured it on Cast Service at the time. There's a lot going on in there, as well as the deep voice guy who does all of the trailers.
Very good.
Thank you for action TV and movies. What can you say about Torchwood Miracle Day based on the trailer? Not a lot. People don't die, apparently. But that, you know, that's the theme of the show. What did you think of the trailer, James?
It was all right. It was a trailer which didn't really tell you anything. There was sort of things exploding and actioning and falling and aiming guns. And, you know, I think it's the sort of stuff which will sell to the market, the American market, which, let's face it, is an important market for it to sell to.
Yeah.
And, I'm still interested in it. I really like John Barrowman. I think he's a good actor. I liked Gwen, Eve Moyles, in the last season of Torchwood. I never really liked her in the previous ones.
Mm.
But if this is going to be more like Children of Earth, as they've said it will be,
yeah,
then I think it's in a good position. And I know there's so many, or I think, silly fans who will have a go at the fact that the Americans are involved in this, or some of it will be in America, and America can't do a good show if it hit them on the head, et cetera, which you'll see on so many Doctor Who forums. But I think America can bring some damn fine quality stuff. And as long as you've got Russell T. Davis at the top there with Gardner, I think it's in safe hands.
I think anyone who says that America can't do television is living in some,
well, they say America can't
remote
do,
North African country.
They say America can't do Doctor Who, I suppose, is more, if I was
to be
fair.
It's not Doctor Who, is it? It's Torchwood. I mean, Torchwood fans as a whole, and if there are any Torchwood fans that I'm about to describe listening, I am not apologising. You really need to get out more. There are Torchwood fans who believe that the first two series are some sort of be-all and end-all. Now, what the first two series of Torchwood were, and again, I'm not asking for forgiveness, but if anyone who isn't a Torchwood fan is offended by anything that I'm going to say or any of the language that I'm about to use, I do apologise. It basically claims to be for grown-ups. Okay, Torchwood Series 1 and Torchwood Series 2.
Yeah.
If you were a grown-up watching Torchwood Series 1 or Torchwood Series 2, and you just tuned in, unless you were just got in from the pub and you were drunk, you'd have thought it was absolute bollocks. It was designed to appeal to 14-year-olds to 24-year-olds. We're talking like elderly adolescents, basically, and students. And that's what it was aimed at. It wasn't grown up. It certainly wasn't mature for the nonsensical alien shagging and nightclub threesomes and all the other sort of thing that went on in there. It just wasn't grown up. But there were some great stories in there, and there's some really good stuff going on in there. But
no, I agree with you.
That whole idea that it is somehow grown up is rubbish. Children of Earth, now that's proper mature, grown-up science fiction.
Yes.
That's packaged and written in such a way as to be broadcast on BBC One, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
And people were talking about it in the way that people don't normally talk about British fantasy shows.
Yeah. I was like me as well. I couldn't believe it. I used to find that I found that Torchwood really shared as much as in terms of adult concepts as Sarah Jane Adventures. I mean, okay, Sarah Jane Adventures didn't have the sex in it, which, given content, is a good idea.
Yeah. So
I really don't want to see K-9 doing it with a toaster or whatever.
Or other... Mr. Smith.
Or Mr. Smith, yes. Oh, that would be a classic shock for robophobes and homophobes alike. And I suppose
robo-homophobes.
Yes. But I totally agree. It was the way it was pitched, and I think that really irked me as well, because I got excited thinking I was going to get an adult Doctor Who, and what we got was essentially, I suppose, what it was commissioned for. As you say, BBC Three,
yeah.
Bored 14 to 24-year-olds. And I mean, the whole concept was just silly, unfortunately. And I don't want to say drivel, but I mean, come on. I mean, that stupid Torchwood card, this secret organization in Cardiff with a car which has big sirens on it and Torchwood emblazed down the side in their
back. I think one or two of those, you could forgive one or the other, couldn't you? But throwing them together.
And then, to have this bat cave as well, which just felt screaming for toys to be made from it, whether they did or not, I really don't care. But it just didn't feel like an adult concept. And I think it greatly disappointed a lot of people, because it just didn't feel like it lived up to what it wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I felt sorry, I think, for a lot of the actors in there, because I think it wasn't until later that they actually really got something to bite into, which wasn't sort of very Buffy-ish. The second season, it just went very Buffy-ish, and that didn't really do much for it either. I agree with you. There's some really good episodes in there. I think, I don't want to get apologetic, but I think there were some good episodes in there. But it wasn't until Children of Earth do I think it actually found its home.
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I mean, that's the development of TV shows, isn't it? Maybe if they'd spent a bit more time on getting it developed to the standard that it was in Children of Earth before it went before the camera, it may not have even got to the.
I don't know. I mean, it could simply be, you know, when you get a show commissioned, you're commissioned for a certain demographic, a certain audience within that demographic. And if they were commissioned for a BBC, not very bright, 13 to 24-year-olds and a few Doctor Who fans tacked on the side, then they delivered what they were meant to deliver, something which was loose, lightweight, had no brains behind it, sex and silliness. And yeah, fine. But I think a lot of I think what we're saying is, I think there was more potential to the show and they didn't find that potential, that it was worth more than that till Children of Earth and now hopefully Miracle Day.
So yeah.
Good luck on that, you guys. I think that should be something to be excited.
I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Because I heard actually in my useless encyclopedia that if you take the word Torchwood and you spin it around, you get but hopefully not anymore. That will change and it'll say Doctor Who or something.
I'm pretty sure that one doesn't work.
No, I think it's possibly Doctor Who. But
yes,
I think the way we look at Torchwood, I think will change a lot over the next year or so.
Okay, well, we're going to move on now to our sort of last item, and we're going to do a mini pseudo book review, or even a mini semi book review, depends on which way you look at it. Now, we do feature books from time to time on Casterbus, and we do get sent an awful lot of books. Sometimes we're not able to review them all, however much we try, due to one thing or another, and the fact that it can be quite tough getting through books.
Yeah.
On demand, as it were. Mm. However, over the last few months, there have been quite a few very interesting new books released or announced to be released. Now, one of these is The Dalek Handbook, which is by Steve Tribe and James Goss, and this is a BBC book. Now, over the last few years, there have been a lot of Doctor Who books released by the BBC. Doctor Who, The Inside Story, The Encyclopedia, The Time Traveller's Almanac... I could go on. They're good books. They've got plenty of interesting content, but they're a little bit lightweight as well. And they're beautifully designed. Gary Russell has been responsible for at least two of them. He's done a great job with them. But it's possibly arguable that they're aimed at a lower demographic than myself, most definitely, but also people with perhaps lower expectations on what to expect from a Doctor Who book.
Yes, a more casual audience.
From an official Doctor Who book. The Dalek Handbook, on the other hand, is probably the best, the writer's tale aside, the Dalek Handbook is the best Doctor Who-related piece of literature to come from BBC Books since the series returned.
That's, and as you say, with such a plethora of, I would call them books, but a paper with lots of glossy photos in is what a lot of them are. That's quite a big thing to say.
It is.
There, big competition. There's
no glossy photos in here apart from on the cover.
Good Lord.
For start off. Inside, you've got nice, slightly DWM-ish page design. Occasionally, you get background images behind the text as little box outs.
Cool.
There's a nice, it's basically a complete history of the Daleks in both Doctor Who and in, you know, in the real world, places where they've also popped up. There's an excellent Dalek spotting guide at the back of the book, so you can spot every different type of Dalek that has been seen in the show, from the silver and blue model from the Dalek invasion of Earth right through to the light grey casing model from 1974 through to 1984. How many am I looking at there? 16, 25, possibly 30 different types of Dalek there. There's screenshots from various episodes, how the Daleks move is covered in there. There's Dalek video games, stuff that's come from the BBC Online video games, as well as things like Dalek Empire from Big Finish. It's exhaustive and it's brilliant. And Steve Tribe and James Goss have done a fantastic job with this book. And I would, it is $9.99, so it's a bit more than a standard original novel. If you had a choice between any of the original novels, even one by James Goss, or this book, I would heartily recommend you get hold of a copy of The Dalek Handbook. It's marvellous. Out on Monday, I think, certainly the back end of May, is by Owen Turner, the man who invented the Daleks, The Strange Worlds of Terry Nation.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Now, I've been very lucky enough to receive a copy of this for review purposes. And basically, I'm focusing all of my current reading energies on this, which means I've had to put down a couple of novels that I'm reading so that I can review the book and know enough about what's in it before interviewing the gentleman concerned. It's a biography of Terry Nation. Starts off with Terry Nation as a young chap during the war, carries on through his becoming a writer, working with people such as, working for Tony Hancock, working alongside Spike Milligan and Galton and Simpson, people like that. It's difficult to describe it. It's brilliant.
Another good book, then. I know this is, yes. This is not from the BBC, is it?
It's from Oran Press. Now, there are links to it on Casterbus, so if you just want to do a search on Casterbus, or you could, Oran is spelled A-U-R-U-M. But if you just Google the man who invented the Daleks, you should manage to find his way to the website, which is auronpress.co.uk.
That should be pretty interesting, because there's a lot of, in Who fandom especially, there's a lot of dispute and debate over the validity of Terry Nation. So I'd be interested to see what's in there. I might actually try and get myself a copy.
I would certainly recommend it. Because there's a nice selection of glossy photos in the middle, which is largely Dalek-related. Or if not Dalek-related, then being a comedy writer as part of Associated London Scripts. Now, here's a nice little bit of trivia for you. I didn't know this, and I should have known this, I think. I think this is something that I've been on the tip of knowing for some years. Terry Nation's first agent was Beryl Virtue, who is Stephen Moffat's mother-in-law.
Right.
How tidy is that?
How
tidy as you like.
How does that fact sit on the tip of your tongue for a few years? That sounds so
specific.
Because
I knew that Stephen Moffat was married to Sue Virtue, and Beryl Virtue was the producer of Men Behaving Badly.
I see. I wish I hadn't asked.
Yeah. So, but, you know, there's more than Doctor Who and the Daleks in this. Obviously, the Daleks were a massive part of Terry Nation's career. But they also set him on the road to doing other things, which are not least trying to launch a Dalek serial in America, but also, you know, The Persuaders, writing episodes of The Avengers, Department S, creating Survivors. There's Blake Seven.
Of course.
You know, there's. I'm not even halfway through yet. I've got most of this to look forward to still. I'm still in Dalek mania.
Oh, I'm really pleased to hear this, because, I mean, I've heard so many Doctor Who fans have a go at him as being a charlatan, that he stole the idea of the Daleks from Tony Hancock, and he steals everything. And is, you know, the guy's got such a list of stuff to his name, and Blake Seven alone, which he wrote the first series himself, you know, incredible stuff. So I think it's good that he's got something so complete coming out now, especially as Daleks are still pretty big.
Well, I think, I mean, the author is under no illusions that Terry Nation wasn't the best, wasn't the most well-rounded writer in terms of he was more interested in action. Now, if you look at the list of TV shows that he was involved in, you know, that's quite clear. And he was brilliant at writing action adventure serials or single episodes, you know, depending on which program you're talking about. He wasn't great at the nuances of character development.
Which is why we have the Daleks, I guess, because, I mean, if you want to have anything which has the most static character development ever, I think you'd probably have to go with the Dalek.
Probably, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, this is, if you're Dalek mad and you've already thought about buying the Dalek handbook, then you really cannot avoid. Basically, take 30 quid to Waterstones, buy the Dalek handbook and the man who invented the Daleks, and I don't think you will regret either purchase.
Brilliant.
And I think that brings us to the end of this podcast. A nice little book review at the end there. We should do a book club, maybe. Maybe not. So we'll be back, or at least a combination of myself and hopefully James will be back next week, where we'll be discussing the horror that appears to be the Rebel Flesh, along with a couple of other things. So thanks for listening, everyone, and goodbye.
You know, if you take Dalek...